It's Robin with Tributaries. Historically, the Greeks recognized two types of knowledge, intuitive and intellectual. Today's guest, Stefan Schwartz, has spent a good part of his life researching remote viewing, which is a technique to very purposefully move into the non-local mind, which I believe is the trip from the intellectual into the intuitive. Stories abound about governments using this process for espionage. After hearing about Stefan's book, The Secret Vault of Time, I started conjuring up the image of a 21st century remote viewing pirate. But after reading his book, Opening to the Infinite, the adventure gets even better because his sights are set on discovering higher consciousness. Stay tuned for part two with Stefan Schwartz. This is Tributaries. In speaking about Jonas Salk and non-locality, you quote him as having said, "Intuition is something we don't understand the biology of yet." Stefan, how many years ago was that, and is it possible that there's no closing the gap and there's no place for science in non-local mind and intuition?
No. First of all, there's not a place because there is no place. It's outside of time space. I mean, part of the problem we have, Robin, is
right.
That,
I mean, that's what I mean. It's like, can science reach?
Yes. Actually, what I think is going on, now, not I certainly do not mean to imply that this is general to all science, because it isn't. But if you look across many disciplines today, what you discover is that science and spirit are converging, and that the insights of one are confirmed by the research of the other. If you look at the remote viewing research, if you look at the healing research, if you look at the near-death research, if you look at the reincarnation research, if you look at the meditation research, and we're talking about thousands of papers now. I mean, there's over 2,000 papers alone, for instance, in the healing literature. And there's probably 1,000 in the meditation literature, and there's hundreds in remote viewing, and then there's all the quantum entanglement papers. And so this is a large body of very carefully conducted research reported in often very prestigious peer-reviewed journals. If you look at all of it, you can see that the experiential description of great sages or spiritual teachers. I mean, you can go back, for instance, to the Sutra of Patanjali, which is over 2,000 years old, and read descriptions that are very much in support of or consistent with the discoveries that are being made in research labs that are looking at consciousness. The oldest remote viewing description that we have in the recorded record, and it is essentially unchanged from the way we would do it today, is a report of a remote, what's called an outbound, that is somebody goes out and hides and you describe where they are. An outbound experiment that is in the 46th chapter of Herodotus, describing Croesus, of whose name we all know as being as rich as, who was the king of the Lydians and got what amounts to a remote viewing from the Delphic Oracle, again, over 2,000 years ago. So this stuff has been recorded. These experiences have been recorded in a myriad of different ways in every culture that humanity has ever produced. It was described prior to the development of science. And remember, science is only about 300 years old. History is about 6,000 years old. And people have been around for about 35,000 years. So the vast majority of human history or of human experience actually occurred long before science began. Science is this tiny little thing at the very end. But the descriptions that you get, no matter what culture you go into, whether it's the East or the West or Native Americans or whatever, they describe this process of opening to this part of the self. And what's happening is that science is confirming many of the statements that are made by spiritual teachers and sages and shamans and that sort of thing. So what I see is that science and spirit are converging. Now, that makes a lot of people terrifically uncomfortable because there is in science, as in the West, a very strong bias toward materialism. That is, dead meat, no consciousness. Or put the positive way, I guess, we are nothing but animated meat. Our consciousness is just the result of biochemical and electrical processes in our neuroanatomy, and we are completely locked inside of our physical organisms except for our five normal senses.
Well, in speaking about the senses, there are some spiritual practices that almost start with the premise that if you can hear, see, smell, taste, or touch something, it's an illusion. It's part of the human mind makeup rather than that non-local mind.
Well, I think what they're trying to say, I mean, I don't know the particular ones you refer to, but what I think you see is in the experiential material, which is the spiritual teachings. Remember, I mean, it's important to remember, before we had science, if you had a precognitive experience, a future-knowing experience, Daniel's interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream in the Bible, for instance, the only way to describe it was within the context of contacting some kind of deity. I mean, whether it was a Christian god or before that it was Zeus, or before that it was Mazda, I mean, that's not the point. We give it a cultural context. That
yes.
is, we have a story we tell about the experiences. But until the development of science, the only way we could visualize or conceptualize these kinds of experience was to say that they were divine, or that they came from God or gods or whatever. There wasn't really any other way to talk about it. That was the point I was trying to make. It's only in the last couple of hundred years, and really only in about the last 75 years or 100 years, that we have had techniques which science has developed to explore these timeless recorded experiences that people have been having and to put them in a new context, that is to put them in a scientific context. So from my point of view, or at least the way I look at it, people have been reporting these experiences for thousands of years, but it's only in the last century that we have had anything other than a way of describing it as being talked to by the gods or God or spirits or whatever. Now, for the first time, and one of the reasons that remote viewing is important is that, you know, when the physicist has this epiphany experience, Einstein says the special and general theories of relativity came to him as he was idling away some time in a canoe. Tesla says he was walking across the park at Central Park in New York and he had a vision of how the motor worked, the electrical motor. Or the experiences that Brahms or Beethoven or Copland or those kind of people have. It's only really in the very most recent time that we've had another way of contextualizing this. And remote viewing, because it doesn't produce these sort of life-altering experiences, you know, when the religious ecstatic has an experience, the experience is so overpowering that they don't waste a lot of time about how they got there. They're talking about what happened. But in remote viewing, because we do sort of very, very homey, mundane things, describe the, you know, somewhere in the closet I have hidden an object, describe the object, and it turns out to be a teacup. Well, because it's not a sort of earth-changing personal experience, an epiphany experience, you can talk more and more easily about what actually happened. And what remote viewing gives us is a way of examining the individual steps of the process so that we can get a better handle on how they operate and which ones we ought to emphasize. And we do little experiments over and over again so that we can find out, Does it make a difference? If you're a man or a woman, does it make a difference whether you believe that you can do this or you're skeptical about whether you can do it?
Right. For example, one thing you mention in the book for remote viewing, it's important to mention your size.
I always ask my, when I do remote viewing experiments, I always tell people you're normal sized. And the reason I do this was before I learned to do that, Hella Hammond was doing an experiment. Actually, she didn't do it for me. She did it for the guys up at SRI. She was a remote viewer for both of us. And they asked her to describe something, and she said, well, you know, it's made out of soft cloth, and it's kind of a tube, and it has black and white stripes, sort of like a barber pole, but then it's got this big red knob at the end of it that's sort of soft and squishy, and they couldn't figure out what it was in this room that they were asking her to remote view that she was describing. Well, it turned out it was a Raggedy Ann doll foot, and Raggedy Ann had, because of her own children, had always been a powerful sort of iconic childhood symbol that her children had liked. They liked the story. And so when she had gone into this room via remote viewing, the thing that she had fixed on, because she hadn't seen one in years, was the Raggedy Ann doll. And so she described it as if the doll, as if she were very, very small, and the doll were she were an ant looking at this doll. And from an ant's eye view, she gave a description of what a Raggedy Ann doll would look like. And it took them a long time to figure that out. So, and I had other similar experiences. So we learned over time, again, this is why the remote viewing process is, that we could take it apart and sort of look at the pieces. We learned to tell people that you are life size. You are standing there. What do you see? Also, there was some work done sort of quasi-scientifically by the Theosophists many years ago. It's recounted in a little book called Occult Chemistry, where they described subatomic particles.
The periodic chart, I know that. Isn't that amazing?
And they described the neutrino 12 years before Rutherford discovered it. So again, you can. What we know about remote viewing is that distance doesn't make any difference. It's as easy to describe something that is across the room as it is to describe what's going on another planet.
And also future as opposed to past.
Yeah, there's no time. So it's just as easy to describe the future as it is the past, as it is the present. I mean, my work, a lot of it has, because I did archaeological research, a lot of it figured on locating things that had been missing for thousands of years. And so for people to do that, I mean, where did they go to get that information? And where has it been stored? And what we've learned from remote viewing is that there is no time or space in this non-local consciousness, that what matters is not questions of time or space, but how much emotion is attached to the image of the target that you're looking for. That is, it's easier to describe a religious shrine than it is a farm field. The reason is because many people have gone into that religious shrine and have had highly emotional experiences, and so the shrine has become numinous, whereas the farm field, which may be very attractive in a photograph, has relatively few people looking at it, and when they do so, they don't look at it with an excited, highly emotional mindset. And so that is the sort of thing that we learn from research, which is also confirmed by the experiential reports out of history. I mean, the reason people see ghosts is that they almost always involve events which are highly emotional. The woman gets murdered, the child is lost, whatever. And people tune into, open to, those high peak emotional moments. So in non-local consciousness, numinosity, that is the emotional charge and awareness of something, is very important. Intention is very important. But time and space don't really matter.
Right. Well, you very generously and succinctly lay out protocol for learning remote viewing in your book, Opening to the Infinite. And Another piece of this that you mention, which also I think has something to do with bringing about a higher consciousness, is that you recommend learning to separate how you feel and what you think.
Yes, I started doing that again. This comes out of the research, because I discovered that most Westerners, in fact, most people, cannot distinguish about their feelings and their thinking. If you say to somebody, well, what do you think about that? They'll answer, well, I feel that we, whatever. Or you say to them, well, how do you feel about that? And they'll say, well, I think we ought to. So many of us really have a hard time distinguishing how we feel about something and how we think about something. So I learned, just by doing these kinds of experiments over and over again and looking at the results, I learned that it was very important to get people to talk about how they felt as distinguished from how they thought, and to help them do that. So in Opening to the Infinite, what I tried to do, I wrote this book, my wife wanted me to write this book, my late wife. I promised her I would do it, and I kept putting it off because I knew it was going to be an enormous amount of work. But after she died, I had, I thought I have to fulfill this promise, and so I wrote this book. And it is basically a manual, just like you get a manual on how to operate your computer. It is a manual that tells you how to access this part of yourself. It's, remote viewing is wonderful, particularly for Western minds, because they want to have intellectual material that they can settle on. We're much more comfortable with intellectual material, informational material, than we are with sort of exotic, strange things. And also, I wanted to get this out of the... I don't like words like psychic. I don't like words like ESP. I think they're very emotionally freighted. I don't even like the word paranormal means, not quite normal. It's something that stands next to normal. And in fact, none of that is true. It's all clotted up with ideas of the supernatural and demons and all that. And I wanted to strip all of that stuff away. It's all nonsense that was built up over time. And instead get down to what are the real root processes that are going on, so that I could teach them to people so that they could open to these experiences themselves and see that this is perfectly normal human functioning, that it is accessible to anyone. Some people are better at it than others, just like some people are better golfers or better violinists or, better gymnasts.
Right.
It's spread through the population. The ability is spread through the population in what's called a bell curve, because it looks kind of like a bell.
Yes.
And there are a few people at one end that are the Tiger Woods, the Itzhak Perlmans, the Federer, the tennis player, the guy who's just won all the swimming medals. And there are a few people at the other end of the curve that either cannot or will not give themselves permission to have the experience. And most of the rest of us fall somewhere in the middle. So you have two parts to this. You have innate talent, just like any other human ability. And then you have what you do with your innate talent, and that is what kind of discipline and practice you develop, and that allows you to channel the very best of your talent in a controllable, clear way, just like any other human skill. And so I wanted to get this down to the level where it was like learning a new game or learning a sport.
Right. Very good. Yes. You say in the book that it's been concluded that the geomagnetic fields affect remote viewing. And do you think ultimately this has to be true? I feel like ultimately a great remote viewer would transcend any type of influence like that.
Well, great remote viewers, I certainly, long before I knew about the geomagnetic field research, which was begun by Michael Persinger up at Arantia University in Canada, and then carried on by James Spottiswood in California. Long before any of that work was done, we were getting extraordinary remote viewing information. The GMF stuff, the geomagnetic field material, is important because it's what happens is when the geomagnetic field alters, and that's largely a function of what's going on in the sun, and particles hit the atmosphere of the Earth and its magnetic field, and they are distorted by that, by these particles coming from the sun, every organism on the planet, everything from insects to human beings, are affected, because our physical organism is the instrument that we use to open to this aspect of our consciousness that's outside of time space. And so just as your television goes a little wonky if somebody puts a strong magnetic field next to it, so if you put a strong magnetic field or a weak magnetic field near somebody, there is a difference in their performance. And what we learned is that when the geomagnetic field was very disturbed, there was a lot of solar activity, that people didn't do as well over time, that's over many experiments that we'd learned this, as when it was quiet and the solar flares were down. And so, I mean, there's nothing particularly unusual about that or surprising. It's just like if I put a strong magnet next to my computer screen looks crazy. We've also learned that you do better if you do a remote viewing 30 minutes either side of 1330 local sidereal time. This is probably also a geomagnetic field event of some kind that we don't fully understand yet.
We've
been trying to look at is, how do you become a better receiver? Well, there are things you can do inside, and there are things you can do outside. The outside things, like geomagnetic field, you don't have much control over that except to choose the time when you do the remote viewing. The control inside is the one thing I tell people, I describe in the book, and in fact, I even give a technique specific to Western minds for meditating. And the reason I do that is because no single activity will determine whether you're going to be a good remote viewer or not better than whether you meditate or not. And the reason is that meditation teaches people how to focus their consciousness. And remote viewing, like all experiences of non-local mind, occur as a result of focus. Now, you can either get that focus through neurotic obsession, which is why many people who describe themselves as psychics have weight problems or alcohol problems or smoking problems, you know, one kind or another. They have a neurotic behavior which they tend to select for because they come to associate it with their ability to access this part of themselves. So you have either neurotic behavior or you have a carefully developed discipline, which is why I describe remote viewing as kind of like a mental yoga or a mental martial art.
Yes, and it's interesting that a lot of people who might end up in a mental hospital have very strong non-local lives.
Oh, yeah, there's research that shows that a lot of people who are in mental hospitals or hospitals for psychiatric disorders often have very powerful, for instance, precognitive experiences.
Yes.
Because they develop these obsessional behaviors, and those obsessional behaviors allow them to, well, they don't allow them, compel them to focus on something, and that focus gives them access to non-local consciousness. In the Delphic Oracle, for instance, the oracle was a young girl who was hung on a kind of cat's cradle thing on a tripod over a crack in the earth from which psychoactive gases came up. I mean, we know all this now. And the young girls were in a kind of altered state of consciousness, and they would issue these prophecies. And that's why there is also a very strong association with non-local consciousness and psychoactive drugs, ayahuasca, salvia divinorum. These are all drugs that were traditionally used in indigenous societies to produce these states of consciousness, marijuana in Native American traditions. So all kinds of... Humanity has been around a long time, and they have discovered, we as a species, have discovered that there are various ways of achieving this focused state where you can open to non-local consciousness, and whole traditions arise, like the Delphic Oracle, that go on for hundreds of years, that are essentially based around some insight somebody had about, well, if you breathe these gases, which are naturally occurring coming out of the earth, you move into this altered state, and while you're there, you can issue prophecies. We can also get this from meditation without a lot of the side effects. And remote viewing is just another way of doing this. It is a way of doing it that does not involve all of the emotional and ritualistic baggage that those other ways require. That's one of the reasons I like it,
is that
it's something anybody can do, and it doesn't require you to go through some sort of strange experience.
Well, you weave so many amazing uses for remote viewing in opening to the infinite, and for one, criminology probes. I know that there are certain police cases that have certainly opened up and used psychics and have found their killer or whatever they're trying to do. And I'm wondering, what are some of the things that you know about that? And certainly there's a woman, Catherine Harwig, I read about in your book, that really takes it all a step further for improving police relations in the community, for instance.
Well, Catherine was a social worker who became a lawyer and an investigator. And what she's doing, which I think was very interesting, which is why I wrote about her in Opening to the Infinite, was... rather than getting the police to go to work with remote viewers, psychic detectives, what she does is teach the police how to do it themselves. But remember, anybody can do this. Some people are better than others, but people can do this. And police are often highly motivated to do it. And she's teaching patrolmen and police cadets how to do it so that if, for instance, they get a domestic disturbance call, which are often very violent because people are kind of crazy and waving guns around, that they can stop before they go into the house and remote view on the other side whether the guy has a gun or not and prepare themselves accordingly. So that's a way of doing it. There is another group of people who are beginning to use remote viewing to select juries because so much emphasis is now put on getting the right people on the jury. And there are, I mean, I guarantee you, I say this with no fear of contradiction, that as you and I are doing this radio interview, somewhere in the United States, actually a number of somewheres, some police person is going to talk to a person they think of as a psychic or a clairvoyant, but who are basically a remote viewer, who have developed some kind of personal technique for opening to this part of themselves so that they can provide information to solve crimes. And there are a number of these that are on record where police have been willing to testify. A woman named Noreen Rainier, the FBI, came down and testified on her behalf.
Okay, I've never done this before, but I'm going to invite you to visit my website in order to hear the interview with Stefan Schwartz in its entirety. I didn't want to just edit out a lot of what he was saying in order to make our 29-30 minute limit here on Tributaries. So for more information on Stefan Schwartz, it's stefanschwartz.com, author of Opening to the Infinite. And for any guest information, to listen to archived programming and to share resources and hear the full interview with Stefan Schwartz, please go to tributariesradio.org. I'm Robin Clare. Thank you for staying tuned.